On behalf of both of us, thank the library and its trustees and the membership for having us. It's a great privilege and honor to be here. I love this place, and at a time when books seem to not be as valued as they used to be, this place reminds us that we're not all crazy. There is a place for us. And so Dr. Lakshin and I are very, very happy to be here. And also I'd just like to acknowledge the presence of our guest, Dr. Stephen Paget, Chief of Medicine at HSS in Rheumatology, and a great friend. Oh, you're having trouble hearing me. Can you hear me now? I feel like I'm running this cell phone ad. Is it all right now, Latreia? Is that all right? But now we've got the bounce back. What am I doing wrong, Julian? Is it all right now?
Yes.
Are we all right now? Is that good? Yes? Yes. Anyway, let me go back to saying that we are particularly pleased to acknowledge the presence of our guest, Dr. Stephen Paget, who is Chief of Medicine and Rheumatology at the Hospital for Special Surgery, a great friend to our book and to me as a patient and, of course, a colleague of Dr. Lakshin's. So this is a book by a doctor and a patient. This the doctor, this the patient. And this doctor is not telling his stories and feelings about patients and interpreting what he thinks patients might feel, but he is, in fact, writing a book with a patient of his. So it's not a book by a doctor who's going to tell you all about a diagnosis quest or how patients present their stories. And in the terms of what I've done, it's not, although it is a memoir about a life lived with illness, it is not the genre of what I call the stall and wallow books of pain and whining. It is certainly honest, and at times I presume people find it a little difficult, but it is a book about a relationship, our relationship, which I think, as a person who has been chronically ill her entire life, the most challenging relationship of my lifetime is that with a physician. So as Mark said, it's a dual memoir. We wrote and we responded to one another, not always in the same order. If you think of the book in liturgical terms, one of us is the petitioner, the other the respondent, and then it turns around. So in one case, I write about the difficulty, indeed the impossibility, of maintaining an intimate relationship in my life over the long course because of illness, and Dr. Lakshin responds to that. In another case, he talks about what it's like to live inside a world that he doesn't fully understand emotionally, but understands totally medically, of other patients like myself and many far sicker than I. And I respond rather dramatically, "Oh my goodness, how do you do this?" So the point is that we learned from each other during this collaboration, and perhaps the nicest thing of all is how much we surprised each other. We thought we knew a lot about our doctor-patient relationship. I think that the patient-doctor relationship, if it works at all, is a stunning miracle. And that's something that is a little difficult to say, because underneath it is a secret that I don't think is so easy to reveal. And it is simply stated that a doctor's status, success, professional triumph, work satisfaction, and often in some cases even financial gratification is based in chronic illness on the limitations, the pain, suffering, and agony of the population he or she serves. And it's a difficult thing to say, but it needs to be said if we're to reach a point where in a relationship that can never be fully equal, a doctor-patient relationship, we can come to a place where there is a kind of equality of understanding. Status differentials are very common in sociology, social sciences. We know a lot about conversations and lawsuits about abuses of power. But what we like to say is that it's also possible that there is a different model. There's a different model for a lifetime of illness and a lifetime of care. I think any doctor who chooses to write a book with a patient is very brave. I think that Dr. Lockshin is much braver in what he has done than what I have done. Because doctors are not usually in the business of revealing so much about what they feel or what might sometimes go wrong. And so for a physician to move from the protection of his or her world and the shield of the white coat is very brave. I was never going to write a book about being ill. My illness is not a total secret, but it's not something everyone in the world knows about. I have written other books, many articles. I wasn't going to do this, but we were more than encouraged by, We were more than encouraged by Mrs. Jane Lockshin, there you are, who is the mother of this book, who said, you know, this book, if you would do it, will be much stronger if you do it together than if either of you wrote one individually. I think if a patient feels that they can write a book with their own doctor, that in and of itself says something about this relationship. It says that there's an amazing amount of trust, and in our case, longevity. How a patient perceives time and the time spent with her doctor at any given moment in treatment is crucial and very different from the way a doctor has to or does perceive time. I think patients are storytellers. We tell stories. That's how we make sense of what's happening to us. Karen Blix and Isaac Dinesen once said, there is no sorrow that cannot be borne if it is put into a story. Well, we somehow feel as patients that if we keep telling our stories, that our doctors will glean from our endless, perhaps sometimes relentless stories, a course of action, a treatment protocol, not always understanding in the midst of our pain or frustration that they've heard our stories before. They've heard them in different voices, in different ages, in different genders. Our stories are unique to us. They're not always unique to our doctors. And so there is that other sort of, we're the storytellers and they're watching their clocks. In inflammatory autoimmune disease, which is what I have and what Dr. Padgett treat, in lay terms, for me, I simply say my body has turned against me. It often feels as if my body is eating itself. It's the metaphor that's worked for me. So time means something to me. Doctors keep a very precious time of their own. It's a different time than the time I keep and my sister and brother patients. When Dr. Lockshin is seeing me, I don't know what else is going on in his doctor world. He might have 4 patients in ER. He might have just gotten a text on his cell phone that someone that he's been treating is on the way in an ambulance. Someone may be calling him from some far-flung place in the world in deep trouble. We don't know what's going on with them, and usually we can't see beyond ourselves to understand that. Yet, there is this dilemma that we feel often, I feel, and I know that other patients feel it as well, that in these diseases that eat us, we're eating up a doctor's time. So this can present a tension that can be unfortunate, because if the time factor is not somehow resolved or at least talked about or managed, it works against the possibility of navigating a full life with chronic disease. I think perhaps in the back of all of our minds, patients, we fear that the doctor thinks that we're wasting his or her time. I'm going to read just a brief quote that was in the New York Times on the 26th of July, and it was about a conference on artificial intelligence held at Asilomar earlier this year, about what's going to happen when robots and robotic non-humans start to outsmart us, and the scientists worry machines may outsmart man was the headline, and it was organized by a Dr. Horvitz, a scientist at Microsoft, and I'm going to read just the last paragraph, which I think is every patient's secret belief and fear and every good doctor's horror that we think this about them. Despite the concerns about artificial intelligence overwhelming human beings, Dr. Horvitz said that the people at this conference felt that these robotic humans, if you will, could compensate for human failing and frailties, and he demonstrated a voice-based system that would be used for patients to talk to a simulated physician on a television screen, and that simulated physician would respond with empathy. For example, a mother says in their demonstration that her child is very ill, and this doctor, simulated doctor, says, "Oh no, I'm so very sorry to hear that." And a physician afterwards told the facilitator, Dr. Horvitz, "What a great idea. I have absolutely no time for that." So that is an example of the big incentive and surely what I think we saw as the mission of this book, that we wanted to indeed show and to tell that while we live in parallel worlds, if not parallel planets, we can keep a dual time. So this book is a dual memoir, but it tells the following story. It tells a story about a doctor who knows how to listen so that this patient had more choices than to simply go away or to say, "No, I won't." Dr. Lockshin is going to talk about a very different kind of time and a far more important time, how we measure time over a course of a lifetime interrupted or challenged by illness, and the metaphor that he came up with that we used throughout.
Okay, I guess different kinds of time. I don't think I'm going to dwell about the time in the office. We need to do what we need to do. Actually, I'll tell you an anecdote because it only happened about 3 hours ago in my office. Is a woman whom I've known for some time came in and just burst into tears in front of my secretary. And my secretary is she's superb and she knows what to do. So she put her in a private room and there went that part of the afternoon. I was supposed to be doing something else. And what it was the her job had become impossible, largely because of the same sorts of things that Ms. Brill has talked about. And so we ended up talking about that. Actually, it cost me a book because I gave it to her to read what she has said about that, about how you deal with that. And those things, that's part of the life that physicians who deal with chronic illness deal with. But the time that we were talking about, when we sat to talk about this book, and I'll give a slightly different story. We were at having lunch together at my home and having a conversation about communication between doctors and physicians. And that's Ms. Brill's training, and she knows how to analyze it. She has a vocabulary and an intellectual structure for that she was giving, basically telling us what we were saying when we were saying this. And that's where my wife said, "You have to write this, write about this." And we both demurred and said, "No, we're not going to do it." And then we got pushed a little bit more and so on. And it happened. But then we were trying to think about how do you organize this book. And clearly it was going to be the fact that I've known Ms. Brill for 30 years and that there were evolutions on that. But the other part of it was just how you conceptualize time was an issue. And for a different part of my life, I'd spent time in the Maya lands in Mexico and Guatemala, and was familiar with the Maya calendar. And it's not a decimal calendar. It doesn't operate the way we count things. We tend to count in decimals. The Maya is counted with different time frames, which were basically instant time, what I refer to as instant time, calendar, clock time, calendar time, and generational time. So that you think of things, and physicians do this all the time. Someone collapses here, has a seizure, has a heart attack, that's instant. You respond, you do something, or something doesn't happen. Someone calls and tells you have a fever, that they have a fever, and they're just aching or something, that's sort of clock time. You start planning, you've got a treatment, you've got a surgery, you've got something coming on, and you have a vacation, or you need to go somewhere, you need to go back to school, is calendar time. But we often deal in generational time. And one of the things that probably happens most when I encounter patients, and several of you know, that by and large the diseases that I deal with start in young youth. You start, that's tautologic. But we became ill at 12. I happen to have seen today three people that I'm seeing who are 19 years old. And what happens when I see a person like that initially is that I have to do what's necessary. She's usually in pain and frightened and so on. She wants to get rid of the pain now, and that's the goal. But I have lots of different ways of doing this, but some of which are going to impact her 6 months from now, and some of which are going to impact her 30 years from now. And I use the term her because it's mostly women that have these types of diseases. And then I have to sit and plan. How do we talk about, we need to do this, I can get rid of the pain today, but this is going to cost you a lot when you're 40. And 19-year-olds don't think in those terms. But I have to think of that, and I have to think ahead of the person for that. So when you talk about what's going through your mind simultaneously as you sit across the table from a youngster who's first encountering this sort of thing, I'm sitting and looking at this youngster, but I'm trying to think of what's going to happen if and when she finds someone that she wants to spend her life with, if and when she wants to have a child. How is she going to be a mother? Can she be a grandmother? And so on. And then work out, not on the day of the first visit, but on the weeks and months of the subsequent visits, how we engage with this, and then listen to what she has to say, try to get her to understand what I'm trying to say, and we basically negotiate the position back and forth. I have a phrase which I use several times a week, probably, and which you've heard many times, and that is, in my world, everything is negotiable until I say it's not negotiable. And that literally means there are most of the decisions that I have to deal with, medical decisions, are not life and death. They're choices and priorities of what's your worst case scenario, having the drug effects or having the illness recur and that sort of thing. And we negotiate this a good deal. One part of my negotiation, and this is in your chapter, is that I have an article I tore out of a journal years ago about a young woman who was very, very sick with one of the diseases we deal with and was hospitalized. And she signed out against medical advice, getting sick of what her doctors were doing to her, and disappeared for several weeks. And the doctors were writing up what happened. She reappeared completely well on no medications. And they asked what happened to her. Well, she was a girl from the Philippines, and she had gone home to a witch doctor who removed the curse that her ex-boyfriend had placed on her. And I have that in my office largely to say that, and this is true, that most of what we do is guesswork. We don't really have terribly solid science that proves that this and this and this will happen. And so we negotiate around the edges and try to relieve pain and try to keep the 19-year-old be a 39-year-old or a 69-year-old at the same time. The issues that come and the tears that come, and there's a chapter also in the book about this, is when things are going along swimmingly. Everything's just beautiful and so on, and suddenly the disease comes back. We don't have huge, great predictive tools to tell that, but suddenly the image that I used, and it happened because I go on weekends to a place up in Westchester, and I had just, Alita was emailing me at one point, and she was not in New York and was in trouble somewhere, and it happened that I saw a red-tailed hawk that is friendly to our woods come into my eyesight at the time, and that struck me as part of the metaphor that the life is going along well and suddenly there's violence because the hawk goes and tears up a rabbit or something like that. Just out of with no warning, it's there and the disease is back, and then we have to deal with it again. During this, it's very hard to plan lives. It's very hard for someone to create an existence, but Ms. Brill has been brilliant in doing so,
not
despite
always.
That. And I guess we can segue into that part that talks about how you define yourself in the face of chronic illness.
Absolutely, but I want to just say that this, one of the surprises, we talked about surprising each other after, when I came to Dr. Lockshin through a reference, I moved here from Berkeley when I was not yet 30, and I had a reference to him from my physician in San Francisco, but I didn't use it because I was feeling well, and then I got very sick very suddenly, and I still wasn't going to see him, and I got through the flare on my own, and it was actually then my gynecologist, who was also attending at New York Hospital, who said, you have to go see Michael Lockshin. Well, then I did wait till I was better, but in terms of surprising each other in this book, I ran into Dr. Lockshin, many years ago, and I had gone into a spontaneous remission, and our relationship as a doctor and patient was still very formal, and we had not yet become at all social friends, and so I didn't call him and say, oh, I'm feeling well. I just didn't need to see him. So I ran into him. A friend of mine's husband was doing a fellowship in oncology, and I'd had lunch with her across the street, and he was walking back to his side of Hospital Row, and I said, Dr. Lockshin, I'm well. Look at me. It's gone. It's gone forever. I'm really well. I was so excited to see him on the street. It was this beautiful day, and I was expecting this great response from this beloved doctor. And he looked at me and he said, oh yes, they do that sometimes. And I was so crushed. And I went home just a few blocks from the hospital, and I thought, well, what a response to my remission. Of course, 3 months later, I was in intensive care having a little exploratory commotion with my lung. He never knew that he had hurt me until he read the book, and then it hurt him a little bit. So it was a very interesting moment. But how one composes a life such as mine, and maybe a number of you who have come, chronic illness has in the middle of it these things that Dr. Lockshin and Dr. Paget and any other physician here, I suppose, call remissions. I call them dirty tricks, because you really do think in that interlude, that it is gone. And you have to get to be kind of old before you understand that it isn't gone, it's a vacation. And I think one of the reasons that I was able to step back and work with him on this book is that I wanted to be able for us to give something to those young women, especially, who lose hope and lose their way. So how is it that you can still have something you pretend or hope to call a real life, a full life? And I think I have had one. I'm not sure I've always been so brilliant at it, but I do think I've tried to live as fully as possible. It's simply the desire to be seen as yourself. And Dr. Lakshin calls a chapter, I am me. I am me. I'm not this enormous, large signboard of neon symptoms flashing on and off as the text with this little tiny footnote called Alida Brill at the end. I'm not, and none of us who are chronically ill are just a whole sheaf of tests that have to be had and adventures toward the ultimate journey of the elusive, impossible, and confusing thing called clear or clean diagnosis. I had been a fan of the writings of Flannery O'Connor for a very long time. I love her style. I didn't know when I was a young, ill, unwell girl, young woman, that she had died of lupus. I'm glad I didn't know it when I was young. But her collection of letters, compiled by her friend Sally Fitzgerald, the collection is called The Habit of Being. Because when people would say to Flannery, how can you go on like this? You're so sick, how can you go on? She would simply say, well, it's the habit of being. And that little phrase has become for me a mantra, for those of you who work with that, or a kind of a daily prayer for me. I've reached a place in my life where I'm humbled by my disease more than I am angered by it now. I also respect it. I respect its inventive, relentless, stubborn tenacity. And I guess in a strange way I'm sort of in awe of it, that it won't go away completely. But I'm also completely in awe of the rheumatologists who stay with us, despite the fact that we don't have cure yet. We have a promising lupus trial this summer, but there isn't cure. And yet they don't desert us either. I think that there's a lot that is often said. Of course, I sort of live in these two worlds because I have a professional relationship with my doctor as a patient, but also as a colleague because we've written this book together. So I have this dual passport. I also sit in infusion rooms and I go to talk to a number of patient support groups. And people often complain that doctors are arrogant. The doctors are tremendously arrogant. I hear that a lot. I think arrogance is a problem. I see it less in the physicians of today than I did when I was a little girl in the 1950s. I sometimes think that patients are slightly entitled to be arrogant. I think we're entitled to be a little bit arrogant. We do push on. But I think also it's important to step back from the I'm the victim part of yourself and realize how much of this, what I call the mountain, of what comes down on doctors of the chronically ill. I have struggled to be a patient. I loved Adrienne Rich's line, a wild patience has taken me this far. I think it's certainly the case that a wild patience has taken this patient a long, long way. But I also think that the word wild is a word I like. I want to seize that word and make it my word, because besides all the things we know about wildness, and certainly the ferocity of some of these diseases suggests that diseases are untamed and pretty savage, wildness also means a passionate desire to do something, an eagerness to be impatiently patient toward a goal. And I guess I have two goals at this point in my life. One is that doctors and patients come together. And Dr. Lockshin said something in a small film that was made where he said, we must come together first, not as savior and supplicant, but as people, because we must do that first for there to be a dialogue. And then I guess the thing that resonates for me and always will is that in the midst of the screaming of a disease and the negotiating with a physician, there is still this glorious, amazing thing called your life. And the poet Yehuda Amichai, whose last volume is called Open, Closed, Open, wrote a poem that's title probably says everything. The title of the poem is The Precision of Pain and the Blurriness of Joy. The touch of longing is everywhere. And I'll just read from early. They're long prose poems. He says, I'm thinking how precise people are when they describe pain in their doctor's office. Even those who haven't learned to read or write are very precise. This one, it's right here. It's a throbbing pain. This one, it's a wrenching pain. But this one is gnawing at me. This one is burning me. This is a sharp pain, and that is a dull pain. Yes, doctor, here, precisely here. Yes, yes. But joy blurs everything. And then he concludes with something that is very helpful to me in making a life that is apart from my disease, even if I recognize that disease is a part of me. And Amichai says, the blurriness of joy and the precision of pain. I want to describe with a sharp pain's precision, happiness and blurry joy. I have learned to speak among the pains.
And you're turning it over to me?
I'm turning it over to you.
Okay. Well, one of the things, there's a personality here you may have noticed.
Is that a compliment?
Yes. And it's amazing things that come across in random comments at dinner. I told Lolita I wasn't going to get political, but I get political. I mentioned that a paper that I was not going to write was going to be the evidence against evidence-based medicine, because everything we read right now is that evidence-based medicine is the way everything should go. So I mentioned to her that she's not a leader brill. She's 4.4, 6.4. Now, if that sounds a little mysterious to you, everything that I do, if I order a blood test, if I give a prescription that is rather expensive, if I ask for an x-ray, if I send a bill to an insurer, she's known as 4.4, 6.4, because that's the diagnosis code. It doesn't care that 4.4, 6.4 is for Wegener's granulomatosis, but it doesn't care at all that she really doesn't have that. It's a very atypical form of illness. It doesn't care at all whether she's 20 years old or 60 years old or 80 years old. It doesn't care at all whether she's diabetic, has hypertension, has had a motor accident, has an amputation, or anything. The only thing that we do in medicine right now is 4.4, 6.4. And with that number, I am supposed to prescribe a drug, prescribe a series of diagnostic tests, and follow a specific set of rules. Even if she could easily be placed in the category 4.4, 6.4, and even if everyone who had that illness was a woman within a 10-year age range with no other chronic illness or no other incapacity, she might say, I don't want to take that drug. I don't like what it does to me. I don't want what it'll do to me 10 years from now, or something like that. There's no options for choice the way things are being told to physicians right now, but it's not going to work because I was going to say under, but it's really very far over 4 over 6.4. You have a person who has a life, who has choices, and who has decisions that she wants to make and will make. And I think what it comes down to is that any physician who doesn't understand that and can't fight that battle against the insurer or against the person who's paying for the blood test or the medication, and support the patient in the decision that this is something I will do, or this is something that I won't do, and this is the way we'll work out, this is the alternatives for us, then I think my profession doesn't have a right to exist if we can't have that negotiation, have the choices made by the individual, and then offer the alternatives that can be done within the context that we have. I think we got a few minutes for questions, unless you want to say anything else.
Questions?
I think one of the reasons we're talking is that pretty much everything within the healthcare system is targeted to certain diagnosis, the word that you just used, and time-limited events. And the concept of lifelong illness and uncertainty is something that has to be put into the system by one way or another. By speaking, I think we would like to think that we have a part of that. But it, as you mentioned, it will be a very long battle, a hard battle.
You think it's winnable?
I think it is, because most people are going to end up fighting this battle. You know, people will have an appendicitis, they'll have their gallbladder out, they'll be in a car crash, they'll fracture a leg skiing. That's their first introductions to the medical world. But there are other introductions, unless you're killed in that car crash. You'll have other contacts, and most people will learn it. I mean, one of the issues we talked about is the sandwich generation. During some of the worst phases of Ms. Brill's illness, her parents were dying. How do you deal with this? I mean, you may or may not choose to want to talk about that. I routinely have people who have parents who are elderly and ill, and their children are having problems, and they themselves are having difficulty coping, that we have to have a degree of flexibility to be able to understand that's part of caring for illness too, patients with illness as well.
Given this, first of all, your enormous skill with words and this lifetime of living with an illness, have you, or might you direct some letters to legislators or something to try to create more understanding? What you were saying a lot is that you can't put somebody in one little category, everyone's an exception, so.
One of the things that I've sort of tried to focus on, because I think it's probably always best to try to focus on the thing you know how to do. As Dr. Lockshin said earlier, a tremendous number of the population of inflammatory autoimmune disease, let's use lupus as the example, affects young women and girls and women. And one of the drugs of choice still is steroid, is prednisone. And I call it the bitter pill in the book, because the very first time I was handed these pills, I took them and I went, oh, these are bitter. And about 3 weeks later, I was no longer the person I recognized in the mirror. For reasons that I don't understand, because I'm not a psychologist or any kind of doctor, I'm just a writer's writer, there's a kind of shame to some of these autoimmune diseases for young women. And they feel they don't want to talk about it, they hide it, they're embarrassed that their faces have blown up, often their bodies as well. So the part of it politically that I've been trying to work on since the book came out is to tell mothers and grandmothers and young women themselves and mature women, get out there, advocate for research money, advocate for, this isn't your fault, you're not to blame, we don't know why our bodies attack ourselves, but you cannot, as I say in the book, you cannot meditate or diet yourself out of it. Some alternative complementary medical approaches might work, but it's not your fault. So I think my political activism has really been that message to women and also to mothers. My own mother died at a very ancient age. She had had me at a very older age for the time. She died believing that it was her fault because she'd been an older mother. And on my birthday, she'd only been dead about a month, I went to speak to an enormous group in Los Angeles, and a woman my age came rushing toward me and said, my 22-year-old daughter is very, very ill with lupus. It's all my fault, you know. I had her at 42. I said, oh, wait a minute. And so, you know, that nothing had changed, essentially. And so that's sort of my political activism. I don't know if that answered your question. But
I haven't read the book yet. I have read
Well, Dr. Padgett has now heard this at least 4 times, and you've heard it 5,000 times. By the time I got to Dr. Lockshin, I was fed up, jaded, suspicious, and an angry young woman. And I didn't think there was a doctor, let alone a rheumatologist on the face of the earth, who had any idea what he was doing. And it was really an all-male world pretty much 30-plus years ago. My experiences were not positive. I was often relegated, and I have certainly learned since I've been on book tour, I was not alone. You're a young woman in the 1950s. You're a girl, let me say. I was a girl in the 1950s before the consciousness of women's movement or anything. You have these terrible flares. By the time your parents get you to a specialist, you're perfectly normal. And of course, these very kindly doctors couldn't figure it out. Most of them weren't rheumatologists, actually. And, you know, one finally said to my mother, well, I'm sorry, I don't think there's a thing wrong with her. I think it's in her head. So I thought I was a crazy girl. I knew that I wasn't, but I knew that this doctor thought I was crazy. And so that was my experience as a young woman. And then as I got to be older, into my 20s, so much of what happened to me was exploratory diagnostic searching. And in fact, one doctor fired me because he couldn't get a clean lupus diagnosis. And we called him in the book Dr. Diagnosis. So I think the good news, the thing that I like to say, is I think rheumatology has changed tremendously since I was a young woman. I think the practice of medicine has changed. But I think the first thing I say is give your doctor a break. Don't come in with sheafs of unfiltered internet information and tell, I know just what I have, because that's not fair. So I think you've got to give the doctor a break. But I think the other thing is that to have the confidence, especially if you're on the younger side or even on the older side, if symptoms are coming out of nowhere, to have the confidence to believe that you deserve this kind of physician and the model that I have experienced now for more than 30 years at HSS. So I think you have to believe in that, but I think also I would like to see a world where some way, somehow, in some fantasy of mine, doctors and medical students especially could come together before they see patients and understand how much of an impact they can have on a patient with the smallest things. Dr. Lakshin did two things without realizing. One is that very first day when I came to that office, thank you, I was all those things, and he came out to get me. He came out to get me. He didn't send a receptionist or a nurse, and he just came out. He said, you must be Alida Brill, I'm Dr. Lakshin. I'd never had that happen. So a window, a little window of trust opened, and it was so important. Just a tiny window of trust. And that other thing was the framed article of this young woman. And while I was looking at him, I was reading it, and I thought, well, this is probably a joke. This is probably a joke. He's got this up here because he, and so I said, I think I was fairly strident and angry in those days, wasn't I? Yeah. And I said something like, what's this doing here? Because that was going to be my determination. And I remember what he said. He said, I keep it here to remind myself to be humble because these are very confusing diseases. A little humility in medicine goes a long way. And also from the patient side, I think what I would say is doctors are human beings too. So for us to come together and find our common humanity, I don't know if that's responsive, but that's sort of my mission.
Yeah, the flip side of it is for the physician to have enough confidence to listen and guess that the patient may be right and actually may know what she's talking about. It isn't so easy. It's really easy to just listen to the first sentence or two or three and say, I know what this is, and go off. What made it easy to care for, well, I don't know, I'd call it easy to care for Ms. Brill, but certainly a pleasure is that she argued the point and stood up for herself. If she thought I was not being straightforward, she would challenge me, and that's really important because, number one, it makes my job more exciting. I have to defend myself. But it also tells me other things. I guess there's one other flip side, so we now have three flips on this, and that is for the doctor to be able to figure out what the patient is not telling.
Mm-hmm. The secrets.
She points out in the book, but I knew this anyway, the first day that I met her, that she was having high fevers and having all sorts of other symptoms, which she knew from prior experience would likely get her hospitalized if I knew the details. And she was not going to tell me that at that time. But also, I had enough experience that by that time to figure out that there's more here than I'm hearing about. And it doesn't necessarily mean that I have to challenge her and say, all right, you're lying to me. I want to hear the rest of this. Although sometimes I will tell the patient that I know you're lying. Now, why don't you tell me the truth? But it needs that level of flexibility also to be able to try to seek out what is not being said.
Daunting job like writing a book when you have unpredictable
I just was hoping no one would ask the question. Well, it's in the book, but I'll tell you that. But I will tell you that it's a very important question. I had a job that I loved very much, a job that I felt defined me, and I thought that I was doing absolutely everything to be as good as any of my colleagues, even though I was in and out of the hospital. I really worked hard. But you know, at a certain point, I was invited to leave. They didn't say that I was invited to leave because I was sick, and it turned out there were extraneous things as well. But it is very, very difficult, and Dr. Lakshin can probably respond to this more factually than I can. I can respond in my case, in the case of many other women I know. You have to, if you are working for an institution and you're not a writer, because you know there's this wonderful thing called the laptop, you can take it to your bed. It's so, that's when you get to the lying and the disclosure thing. You see, do you say to someone when you're applying for a position, well, actually, I have this disease and I never know when it's coming? And are we banks? Are we applying for loans? Do we have to do full disclosure? If we tell them immediately, do we come under the Americans with Disability? I mean, there's all of this stuff. But I think that in a practical sense, whether you're a writer or a litigating lawyer, it's pacing yourself. It's listening to your body. Dr. Lakshin always says, pain is the great teacher. If your body's in pain, it's talking to you. It's pacing yourself. And unlike other things, like perhaps a bad head cold, you can't just push your way through a flare any more than someone with recurring cancer would try to push their way through a recurrent cancer and not bother to have that second round of chemo. It's different, but it is the same. So you have to listen to your body. I think now that I'm as old as I am, I guess if I were trying to get a job in an institutional situation, I would tell the truth up front. I didn't used to do that. I tried to hide it. I worked through it and then got very ill. There are no easy answers about work and chronic illness, are there?
No, but I actually would give different advice.
Okay, and you do it.
The advice I end up giving is disclose what you need to disclose, and no more, because one thing people regard you as a pariah, they think it's an infectious illness, and so on. There are many, many reasons that people will find to avoid or not assign work or do a variety of other things when their identification of you has a label on top of it.
That's he's giving you better advice.
Okay.
I have a disease that at times has skin involvement, which seems to be at the moment contained. It was very much out of control at the same period that we were going through the worst of the AIDS epidemic. And the Great Plague, where we were losing so many lovely young people to AIDS. And sometimes these lesions would come in places I couldn't hide. Often they would be on my elbows or my toes, I could hide that, but they would sometimes be on my fingers. And during the AIDS epidemic and what I call the plague, and there have certainly been books that have called it that, people would assume I had HIV/AIDS. What is that, you know? And, you know, I would Band-Aid my fingers. And I felt very much that was a moment where I really understood how people inside the AIDS community must feel. What I had was absolutely not contagious. AIDS wasn't airborne either, but I understood what it feels like to be marginalized by disease. I think what I was saying was not so different from what you're saying. I would say something. I certainly wouldn't be disclosing as if I were trying to get a mortgage.
Hey. I think
more question for this one. Listen to your talk. I'd love to read your book. I haven't read it, but I think interestingly, you haven't at all confronted the problem that a dedicated doctor who looks for the name of things. I mean, one of the things that we seem to be obsessed with is that things must have a name. Certainly, we have a number because that's how you get paid. But how, over the years, have you maintained your own mental health?
He writes about that.
I have two daughters that were doctors, and they're good doctors. But sometimes what comes up when you're a good doctor is the uncertainty in the middle of the night, the fact that you have not come up with a name, come up maybe with a number that you can satisfy an insurance company with, and you wonder whether you are doing the right thing. Is there a test you should have done? Is there something you said to the patient that got them all riled up? How have you handled that so that you maintain what also used to call tranquilitas?
The first thing I'd answer is, you know the definition of a rheumatologist?
No.
It's that physician who lives most easily with uncertainty. And for the rest of it, I'd ask you to speak to my wife. She knows what happens. But the answer is yes. So there are lots of nights that I don't sleep at all because I'm concerned about something. But, you know, I don't know what makes a personality and makes that tolerable. I'll tell you what makes it tolerable is when you get it right and somebody really benefits from a decision that you've made at that particular time.